You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 53 of the Fabulous Peldon Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin
Peldon. And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And you may have noticed that this is our second podcast of the week.
This is 2 weeks in a row with two pods. But yeah, you should definitely, if you haven't already, check out our 2017 Seahawks draft recap with the great Zach Witten.
The always wonderful Zach Witten, the third Peldon brother. Some are calling him that. Me, just right now.
Yes. He's developed a great chemistry with us. He was really a great fit. So we're excited to have him on. And stay tuned. We can promise that next week there will again be a second special episode. So
oh, really? Tuned. Wait. The guest for next week, I'm going to throw this out there. They are a gold medal winner. And it's not Usain Bolt.
I think that makes it too obvious.
Does it?
I think so.
That makes it too obvious?
I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. We'll see. we'll see. I guess we'll see how obvious that makes it. Anyway, should we get to what we're drinking today?
Should we? This is something which I found out about literally this weekend and have been waiting so long to try.
I discovered it on Instagram following loyal listener Nate.
Oh, really?
Who's drinking this beer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He brought it to my attention. And that is a collaboration between Rubens Brews and Rainier Brewing Company, the R&R Pilsner. So Rubens is the small R.
Uh-huh,
that's their
uh-huh.
logo. Rainier. It legally distinct from the Peldon Cast logo.
Uh-huh,
it's a capital R.
Yeah.
Together they are R&R. They came together on this beer. Let's see if I have a good quote here from the press release. The Rainier brand manager apparently was a frequented the Rubens Brewery brew house, and that was kind of where this idea was hatched, that they could work together. Talked about how you know, they don't have kind of the craft experience that a place like Rubens does, but have the scale to produce something like this in a greater way than Rubens really can.
Maybe our guest next week is a gold medal winner in beer.
I didn't even think about that. Wow.
Yeah. You haven't thought about that at all.
Should we crack this open and see if it merits a gold medal?
This made the most sense to us, right? I mean, when anytime there's an R, we're interested.
That's true. I mean, we stopped being interested pretty quickly in the Pale Mountain Ale, I gotta be honest. Their last foray outside the main Rainier
brand. I'm not interested in that at all.
No. Mostly interested in different variety of Jubilee cans that are...
I've got a Crowler over here, and I'm having a hard time with it. I'm gonna need some help. This is a Peldon Cast first. We need the third Peldon brother here to help us open up this can.
There we go. Whoa.
Huge shout out to Nate also, the third Peldon brother.
So many third Peldon brothers. It's like the fifth Beatle of this podcast.
So I was reading some reviews of this online on untapped.com, I believe.
Okay.
And some people were very excited about this beer. I wasn't sure what to expect because, as you know, Rainier is easily the best beer in the world, right? But also, okay. there are others who... Let me pour this. This is not going well.
It's not going well.
There are others who see it as maybe a replacement level type beer.
It's beer, as you've put it. It's the flavor of beer.
Yeah.
But of the beer-flavored beers, it is the best beer-flavored beer.
But this seems like... This might be a prestige beer.
Yeah, it's somewhere like in between. Because, I mean, it's a Pilsner. You're only going to be able to do so much with a Pilsner. But like I said, they were looking for that kind of craft brewery experience and feel.
Oh, well. Cheers to R&R and one P that looks nothing like an R.
Yes. What do you think?
Tastes like beer.
Don't good.
Do you want to know what I drank earlier today?
What did you have earlier today?
I drank a beer. I can't remember what the exact name of it, which was to celebrate Tacos Chuki's second location opening. This beer was brewed.
Wait, seriously?
Seriously.
What a convenient segue into us discussing Taco's Chew Case.
It was excellent beer, too. I thought to myself, we need to get this and drink this on a future podcast.
Who brewed it? No idea.
Chuki. I know. I'm gonna look it up right now.
That was some excellent preparation for this podcast. Speaking of the second Taco's Chuki's location, the first is in Capitol Hill, right on Broadway. A favorite of ours, what we consider the best tacos / baby burritos in Seattle. They opened up a second location in the South Lake Union area, and I stopped by there on Saturday night, and it was equally good. Not that that was necessarily surprising, but it was good to know that just for sure.
Can you tell me about the second location? What's the deal here?
In terms of what? I mean, it's like...
Is it a bougie Taco's Chuki's?
Yes.
It's fancier?
It feels
is it
part
more,
of the
is it more expensive?
I don't think so, no.
Because this beer, actually, I like the beer, but it made me a little bit nervous.
Because it was too high class?
Yeah, it was just like, there's like a very nice beer now affiliated with Taco's Chuki's. The kind of charm of Taco's Chuki's is its working class nature, right? You're going to go get an excellent taco or burrito. It's going to be pretty cheap, and you're basically drinking a Tecate.
Generally. I mean, they still had the same beer options at this location. They did not have a fancy, bougie beer on the menu.
They really didn't? They didn't have this beer?
I don't think so, unless I missed it.
I'm doing a lot of research on it, and I feel like I may have dreamt that this happened.
That's starting to make sense to me. How much beer did you have before you drank this beer?
This was beer number one. No, this really happened, but I cannot find it. So it was at Mollusk, Seattle. Have you had Mollusk?
Which is across the street, right?
Oh, really?
Yes, that's the deal here.
Okay, so it was a Mollusk beer that it's called Cervezas Chuki's. And it's like a Mexican-style lager. It was like fruity Northwest hops. It was very good.
Interesting. So that makes sense why they would want to celebrate that new location, since it's right next door to them.
I didn't realize that Mollusk was right there. I've had their beer, and I'm very into it.
I didn't know that they brewed their own beer. I saw that it said, like, you know, bar and brewery or whatever it said on there, but I didn't realize what was really going on.
You didn't realize what the word brewery meant?
No, I understood that. It just seemed strange.
I mean, I didn't think they brewed their own beer at that brewery.
You know, they no longer brew beer at the Rainier Brewery, for example.
Oh, that's a good point. But it's called the Historic Rainier Brewery, isn't it? Or the Old Rainier Brewery?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think they're pretty accurate over there.
Anyway, should we discuss the food at Taco's Chuki's?
Yeah, we should discuss the food at Taco's Chuki's.
So they specialize in adobada.
Okay.
Which is marinated pork
mm-hmm.
that is delicious.
Yeah.
I think you generally can tell when you're getting good marinated pork if it's like on, you know, the kind of the cylindrical thing where they're carving
yes.
slices off. That's how you know it's good.
Is that what's happening at Taco's Chuki's?
You can't necessarily tell that at the original Capitol Hill location, but you can. It is very visible.
Oh,
at the other
really?
Location.
See, I've only been to the Capitol location, so I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know that you're getting good pork if it's carved off of a spinning thing, right?
Absolutely.
That's the number one way to tell. And also, marinated pork, the adobada, is the number one meat.
I would agree.
If you can perfect that, like there are other meats that are good no matter what, but a good adobada will beat almost any other meat.
I mean, I'm normally looking for al pastor style.
Oh, and pastor.
Yeah, which is along the same lines. And so their specialty is the Taco's Chuki's, which come with the adobada meat and then a slice of pineapple on top,
mm-hmm.
which is a great flavor combination. A lot of good guacamole on there in like a crema sauce.
To me, my favorite item at Taco's Chuki's, which also I'd like to note that they have cactus, which is pretty unique for a place like that. And I didn't realize how interested I was in cactus before going there. But to me, the number one item is the baby burrito.
Yeah.
Because it's a freshly grilled tortilla, right? It's very soft and gooey. And it's simple. That's what I like the most about it. There's not a lot going on. It reminded me a little bit of the Pasadita in Chicago, which I think was highly ranked in the burrito bracket.
Very highly, yeah.
It's basically just like you got meat and maybe some onions inside of there. There is no fluff. It is all about how good their meat tastes and how good their tortillas are.
So my general go-to order at Taco's Chuki's would be a baby burrito and then two of the Taco's Chuki's.
That feels about right. I could do two baby burritos and two tacos. And two tacates.
That's a, yeah, you got to double up all the way around there.
It's a triple double.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is. So do you think there are any strong contenders to Tacos Chuki's for the best tacos in Seattle?
Not even close.
I mean, there's good like taco truck burritos, but this is just it operated a whole different level than that.
I'm trying to think of anything that could even compare.
I mean, we've had some decent burritos here and there.
I've had some fine burritos, but nothing that just every single bite you have it, it's like, well, it's a game changer.
Did you know that there was a Rancho Bravo in Fremont?
The original Rancho Bravo is in like Wallingford.
Is it?
Yeah, it's across like by UW.
I did not know that.
So yes, I did know. It's basically a food truck.
No, there's one in Fremont.
Fremont proper.
It's on 36, or you know, the main drag there.
Huh. See, I was into Rancho Bravo before I had Tacos Chuki's, and honestly, Tacos Chuki's has made Rancho Bravo taste worse to me.
That's fair. That's reasonable. I can buy that.
We'll do our search for the best burrito in Seattle later, though. But what we're focused on right now is the search for the best burger in Seattle.
And this, you'll recall, after we skipped a week, today we go with two burger reviews.
Yes!
One isn't enough.
I ate burgers in two consecutive days.
Matching what I did last week. So I had gone to Blue Moon Burgers. I went to the Fremont location. That was where I found out that the Rancho Bravo is in Fremont. I went there before I went to Portland for the playoffs a couple weekends ago. So it's been a little while, but I can still generally recall the experience.
Okay.
You went more recently because that's why we weren't able to review it last week.
I went on Monday.
What did you think?
I thought it was a fine burger.
And we both went with the double cheeseburger, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was kind of just a burger. So I would say positives. I thought the cheese was perfectly melty.
Yep.
Right? I thought the burger tasted fine. The bun was fine.
Fine being the key takeaway. My review noted overall awfully plain and pretty meh to me.
The real issue to me, though, was not anything about the burger. It was about the sauce.
Uh-huh.
Which they do a combination ketchup and mustard.
Yep.
Which is fine. I'm not against a ketchup mustard combo, but I can do ketchup mustard combo, right?
Yes.
I can squeeze two bottles together anytime I'd like to. What I'm looking for is some kind of special sauce, which I looked on the menu after to see if that's something that I could have ordered, and I think it may have been available, but your signature sandwich should have the special sauce on it.
Yeah,
basically every sandwich you get should have the special sauce on it, which the place that we're going to talk about next has the sauce on it every single burger.
Yeah, let's do ratings first, I guess. I was going to note that, by the way, I thought there was a good amount of mustard on my burger, but not enough ketchup.
It was saucy enough. The burger that I had was saucy enough. It was not dry in any way. It was a good burger. It just doesn't, it's not even in the conversation for the best burger in Seattle.
All right, what did you rate it?
Did you get fries also?
I did.
I would describe the fries as pedestrian and not in the Doug Baldwin way.
they're like very small and crispy, right?
Yeah. They're almost no flavor to them, though.
Yeah.
They were kind of just a fry.
Yeah.
I think the overall experience was just fine, and I'm giving it an 85.
As did I.
Wow.
There you go. Consensus 85.
Okay. Well, we can agree that Blue Moon is an 85 burger place.
We can.
Didn't really think it would be a contender going in, but we had to go there.
Someplace that we did think was a contender going in was Red Mill, where we visited together on Tuesday before conducting our interview for next week's second podcast.
Man, I love Red Mill.
Red Mill's great.
On our way to Ruben's Brews to go and interview the brewmaster. I love everything about Red Mill, basically. The only thing that I don't love about it is that it's not open on Mondays. I'm not sure if it's the best burger in Seattle, but it is very close.
I would agree with that assessment. So I think, you know, what's interesting about what I do, usually we've generally been ordering the same thing. Here at Red Mill, my go-to order is just the plain cheeseburger.
It's crazy to me.
Despite the fact that everyone loves the bacon pile at Red Mill.
How do you not get bacon there?
To me, it just doesn't add enough for what they're charging for it. I just, I constantly find myself
this is
underwhelmed
when
I order the
bacon.
This is
an exercise that we're doing, though. Cost should not be a factor. Spare no expense in this search for Seattle's best burger.
But you'll note that when we did our ratings for example, Giddy Up Burger, or on the other end of things, Loretta's.
I got bacon at all these places. But any place that bacon was available, I got
the
bacon.
The cost of these was a factor in those.
Okay.
It's we're trying to rate the overall satisfaction. And to me, the satisfaction is higher. It's like the marginal difference of adding bacon is very small.
Okay.
And part of the reason for that is because of the fact that I think Red Mill has the best combination of cheese and secret sauce of any place that we go to.
Not even close, right?
There's like a little kick to it, which is nice. It's very flavorful.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. I was so excited. Every bite. So I had a Red Mill deluxe burger with bacon, right? Is that what I had?
That sounds right.
Yeah, something like that. And I think I could have eaten two of them. I was so excited about having the one.
I was thinking maybe I should have gone. I don't know. Their double cheeseburger options are a little more dubious.
That would have been a very Pelton Guest thing if we would have gone back and gotten another burger.
Yes.
So
yes, it would have.
If I have to, the positives are the cheese. It's very melty. The sauce is great. The bun is excellent. There's a lot of good stuff on there, right? I got the more deluxe one, so it has the onions and the tomato and the pickle. Everything is top-notch. The burger is a thin burger, and really, it just brings nothing to the table.
It's just setting the table for everything else. It doesn't take anything off the table.
I could maybe even use a little bit more from the burger. I don't know if I necessarily want it to be thicker, but I would like a little bit more flavor from it. They're saying cheese and secret sauce, you lead the way. It's almost like having your 5'8" point guard be your superstar, right?
Oh, wow. Another segue, but we're not ready to get to that yet.
But for this burger, I could have used a little bit more.
Okay.
I'm having a very hard time with whether I think, I don't know what my ratings are for these other burgers. I say a rating and then I immediately forget about it.
That's great.
But I'm thinking that the fries are solid. The whole experience is solid. Everybody's happy to be there. You just feel good when you go to Red Mill.
The Sonics banner and solid. The Seahawks 12th man flag, yeah, or whatever they had.
It's
that's
a classic
solid
Seattle location, right?
Yep.
I would say the most classic Seattle burgers, you have Dick's, obviously, Red Mill, and Kid Valley.
Yeah.
And I think that we'll see about Dick's. I know that Red Mill is going to beat Kid Valley, and I'm giving it a 93.
I gave it a 92. So we're pretty much on the same page here. So a 92, you have no idea where that rates.
It seems pretty good, right?
But I can tell you that it puts Red Mill third behind Unita and Little Woody's.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have what it is for me?
I don't know.
You're not scoring mine at all.
No, I mean,
they just
I'm going to
disappear into the abyss.
I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to some of the old podcasts to get those ratings from you.
Can you summarize for a little bit while I go to get my phone to see what we're going to eat next week?
What should I summarize here? How many burgers we've done, maybe? We currently now are at 6, 7, 8, 9 locations so far in the search for Seattle's best burger.
Wow. We're getting down to it a little bit.
Because you originally picked, what, 16?
That feels about right.
And but your thought was that you wanted to go beyond this current list, correct?
I want us to be eating burgers. By the way, I have a perfect time for us to go to Linda's.
Okay.
We're going to do a birthday dinner for me at Linda's.
All right, I'm in on that.
I wanted to go until, like, we're eating our last burger on the week before the week one of the NFL season.
To really take us through the offseason. We started this more or less at the beginning of the NFL offseason.
Okay, so we know when we're doing Linda's. The rest of these are...
I guess that's not quite true. We started this right after All-Star break, now that I think about it.
Do you want to try 8-ounce burger bar?
We could do that.
All right. All right. That's what we're doing.
It's a plan.
I'm fired up about this. I'm just so excited about eating burgers. Okay, so next week we will have eaten 8-ounce burger bar, and we'll be getting down to it as far as burgers go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and tweet the list of burgers with these check marks, emoji check marks that I've put next to them, and would like some feedback if there are burgers that I don't have included. I know some people have suggested some places that I may have missed along the way. I tried to get all of them. But any feedback that you have, let us know, and we should have time to hit them.
Yeah.
So... And we'll be happy about it because it means we're going to eat more burgers.
I like that you ate burgers back-to-back days, and it just did not wane your interest in eating burgers whatsoever.
I would eat burgers 7 days a week. Burgers are great.
You raise an excellent
when
point.
When we do our search next off-season for the best burrito in Seattle, I'll say the same thing, too.
True. All right, should we go back to your segue and talk a little bit about the NBA playoffs here?
Of course we should.
Because a toast to Isaiah Thomas for the second highest scoring game in the playoff history of the Boston Celtics, who last time I checked have played a lot of playoff games.
Really?
Yeah. John Havlicek had 54 in, I believe, 1973 off the top of my head, and Isaiah scored 53 on Tuesday night.
I saw your tweet and I thought only Michael Jordan, Allen Iverson, and Charles Barkley had scored.
That was since the NBA-ABA merger that I was...
Oh, okay. This was pre-merger.
Yes.
Well, I don't even consider that stats.
Yeah. It was a totally different league back then.
Yeah, this is the most points in Celtics history.
Okay. We could go with that. Yeah, that was my tweet on Tuesday night. So... because of the fact that we don't it was harder to access the complete data going all the way back through NBA history, but it's easy to get through 76, 77. And in that span, players who have scored more points than Isaiah Thomas, Michael Jordan did it 6 times. Allen Iverson did it twice.
We're just going to read your tweets now.
Charles Barkley did it once, and that's it. That's the full list. LeBron, never.
Yeah, that was
Larry
kind of crazy.
Bird, never.
I think LeBron was the one that surprised me the most.
I mean, he's had big games, but it's not usually... I think 49 was his highest scoring game against Detroit in 2007 in the conference final.
Is there a game score for this?
There is a game score for this on basketballreference.com. It was a 41.3, which is the highest in the playoffs this season.
Okay.
And it ranks 27th since 1983-84, which is far back as they have that calculated.
Oh, man. I thought it was top 5 playoffs ever.
No, it wasn't.
My perspective on this game may be a little bit skewed.
I mean, Isaiah is usually probably going to have most of his value tied up in his scoring and not so much in the rebounding department or the steals and blocks department. It is better than any Sonics playoff game that was played in that span.
Really?
You know, you want to guess who had the highest game score for a Sonic?
For a Sonic?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to guess Gary Payton.
You would be wrong.
I'm going to guess Sean Kemp.
Nope.
Really?
Ray Allen. 2005 game 4 against Sacramento.
Oh, wow.
Where he hit a bunch
of
threes.
No recollection of that game.
Oh, we watched it in your room.
Did we?
Yep. No. It was some sort of event that we went to that night beforehand and then came back and watched that game in your
room.
Was
it a clinching game 4?
No, they came back and clinched at home in game 5. Had lost game 3 down in Sacramento. We watched that at our cousin Chris's house.
Huh, don't remember that one either.
Yeah. This is a stunning display. I could keep going with this.
So this was
except those are the only 2 playoff games that year that I did not attend. So the other games would all be just ones I was at.
You attended the ones in San Antonio also?
Yeah,
really?
I traveled to San Antonio that year.
So you know where you attended the other games. Do you know where I watched the games that you didn't attend, though?
I don't, but one of them was played on Mother's Day. I can tell you that.
Oh, really?
The other thing... I looked up.
We should do it in a playoffs. Just like we should dig deeper though. You know, the 2000s wasn't long enough ago.
93 playoffs.
Yeah, let's do the 93 playoffs coming up on a podcast when we have nothing else to talk about.
I don't know if you saw this, by the way. So last night, the Warriors after that Celtics game, the Warriors played a game where they had 5 players who had at least 5 assists, and it was the first time that it happened since the Sonics did it in the 93 conference finals against Phoenix.
Oh, and you want me to name the 5 players?
Oh, you should do that, yeah. I don't actually know what they are off the top of my head, but I can look them up.
Wait, this is the 93?
1993.
Against Phoenix.
Yes. The year that the Sonics lost in Game 7.
They had 5 players with 5 assists.
Yes.
Okay, I hope that I don't name somebody who's not on the team. Okay, GP.
I mean, I haven't looked at it yet. I'm assuming that's
but
true.
That has to be right.
It seems logical. All right. Tom Haverstraw tweeted the link. So Shout out to Tom Haverstraw. I've got it. The Sonics actually lost this game, by the way, 120 to 114.
I mean, just having a lot of assists doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Charles Barkley scored 43. Had a 43-15-10 triple-double in that one. Dan Marley hit 8 three-pointers and scored 34 points.
God, I hate Dan Marley.
So the Sonics lost despite 33 points from Sean Kemp and 27 from Ricky Pierce.
Okay.
All right. So Gary Payton is one.
Gary Payton.
He had 8 assists to lead the team.
Nate McMillan.
7.
Ricky Pierce.
5.
Derek McKee.
That is correct. He also had 5.
Sean Kemp.
No. He had 4, amazingly. There was a lot of assists in this game.
Dana Barros.
Nope. He did not have an assist in his 5 minutes of action.
Things got a lot harder here. Eddie Johnson.
He did not have an assist in 15 minutes of action.
Really? Oh, no.
Well, there's one more key player you're not naming here.
Oh, man. Who is it? This was pre-Kendall Gill, right?
Yes. This player started the game, played 38 minutes.
38 minutes?
Had four steals, remarkably. Two. This dead air is great.
Podcast. I'm trying to think.
Going to name some, go through some Sun stats while we're here. Let's see here.
I'll just be over here thinking.
Tom Chambers scored 11 points off the bench. Kevin Johnson had 13 and 10. The Suns had 32 assists as a team against the Sonics, 35. Sonics had 14 steals in this game, including this mystery player who you not have not yet named, who led the team with four steals.
I've got no idea.
Sam Perkins.
Oh, I thought he was on the team the year after.
No, he was acquired at the trade deadline that year.
Ah.
All right, that's been a fun trip down memory lane.
but where did you watch the game?
I'm sure it was in our basement. I don't specifically remember that one, but I remember watching at least part of that series.
Watched a lot of games in the basement that year. It was a hot summer. And do you want to know? Isaiah Thomas is having a cold summer. Oh. He is a White Walker right now. Isaiah Thomas is cold and efficient.
He's the king in the fourth. That's his nickname.
Putting it's just like the king
yeah.
of the north.
Yeah, yeah. That was the reference.
Putting the team on his back as the smallest player on the team, and I ask you, I've been pressing you on this for multiple years. How can people hate on Isaiah Thomas now?
I don't know, but good news, I've already written a story about Isaiah Thomas for ESPN Insider that will be up. Presumably, yeah, maybe shortly after you listen to this podcast, if you listen to it really early Thursday morning, but probably up by the time you listen to it.
Are you saying there's no way to anymore? Because I've felt throughout the years people repeatedly saying, Isaiah Thomas can't do this, Isaiah Thomas can't do that. And no matter what happens, at some point you have to accept this is who he is.
I mean, one of the things I said in that particular piece is that he's acing his final test. And then I did say something about, like, oh, people will still say, well, he has to do it against the Cavs. But, you know, he had 29 points in the fourth quarter in overtime.
Who's a better defensive team, the Cavs or the Wizards?
Over the course of the season, I believe the Wizards were barely. Neither of them are good. The Wizards finished 20th in defensive rating. The Cavs finished 22nd.
I mean, why does he have to do it? I just don't get... I don't understand the dialogue.
Because it's a moving goalpost. That's how moving goalposts work.
But why doesn't anybody else have a moving goalpost?
Oh, lots of other guys do, but he...
Okay,
he
other players do. But why does Isaiah have such a moving goalpost
because
that
he's 5'9"? That's it. And because
what is this
issue? He was the last pick of the draft.
Do you think Russell Wilson still has a moving goalpost after winning the Super Bowl? And going to another Super Bowl the next year?
Well, we'll see when he faces Andrew Luck this year. We'll find out just how far those
We'll see when he faces RG3 who's better. Then we'll know.
Can I drop my last game score stat, though?
Okay.
So what was the best playoff game by a Seattle player or UW player?
This wasn't
before
it?
This. No, this was.
Okay.
Before this.
A Seattle player or a UW player?
Which is the same one.
Delef.
No. No.
Brandon Roy.
Yes.
The game, 45 points?
Not the one against Dallas, by the way, which was like his last great hurrah, which is a game I ended up writing about for ESPN.com before I worked for ESPN. That's like one of my life highlights, that game.
Really? Because you write for ESPN a lot now.
But back then, I didn't. And I especially didn't write about Brandon Roy that often. He had a 31.4 game score against Houston in game two of the 2009 first round. Scored 42 points on 15 of 27 shooting.
I remember that game. I think he banked a really long three to end a quarter or something.
No, you're thinking if he banked a really long three to... or yeah, I don't know. I think that was in the regular season.
It was a good play.
He's great. And Brandon Roy
is great.
Speaking of Brandon Roy, we sent out our well wishes to him in his recovery after it was reported on Tuesday that he was the victim in a shooting while he was in Compton, I believe, over the weekend. Some details in this story that came out afterwards, first broke by Steve Bunin of King 5. The LAPD later reported that he was with his family watching, you know, it was kind of a party, I think, where they were watching some kids play basketball, and the suspects drove up and didn't say anything and opened fire and Roy was protecting his niece, kind of grabbed her in a bear hug and took her to the ground, and in the process of that was shot twice in the butt and in the thigh, I think. And was originally treated in LA, but since his return to Seattle and apparently on the road to recovery.
Well, cheers to Brandon Roy. That is a very strange story.
It is a strange and horrifying story, but glad that things were not worse. None of the adults who were shot suffered life-threatening injuries. So glad that was not worse.
Yeah.
All right.
I have nothing else to add to this.
Should we talk about the Sonics Arena?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
So Tuesday was the one-year anniversary of the city council voting against the street vacation proposed by Chris Hansen's group to build their arena, the vacation of Occidental Avenue, just south of Safeco Field. And Chris Daniels on King 5, a link to this in the post note, had a good piece looking back on the past year and everything that's transpired with Russell Wilson joining their group. The Hansen group deciding to privately fund their arena instead of asking for any public financing whatsoever. And then, of course, the Key Arena options. And the most interesting nugget in that story was Daniels reporting that there was a conversation between Chris Hansen and Mayor Ed Murray where the mayor asked Hansen whether he was okay with them exploring Key Arena renovation, and that Hansen said, yeah, it was okay with him because he didn't really think it was feasible or that anyone would step forward. And lo and behold, that was certainly not the case. So a bit of a misjudgment there.
So he may be right about the feasible aspect of it. We're not
sure
there.
That's a fair point. So in that line, we found out a lot more about the proposals from the Oakview Group and Seattle Partners to renovate Key Arena, because King 5, again, had the full PDFs of the proposals that they sent the city in response to their request for proposals for renovation. So we previously had seen kind of like the executive summary, essentially, and some of the visuals. But this was the nitty-gritty, including a lot of details about what they propose in terms of a lease.
Okay. So can you walk us through each of those agreements?
Yeah, so I've...
And which particular recording artists will be performing, depending on which group gets it?
We know Pearl Jam is associated with the Oakview plan. So I highlighted a few key places where we can contrast. First off, the timelines that they proposed. Oakview proposed beginning renovation on January 3rd, 2019. Very specific date. And anticipating an opening of the arena on October 1st, 2020. As we've discussed previously on the podcast, the fact that the NCAA tournament will be held at Key Arena in March 2019, 2 months after they anticipate beginning, complicates that timeline.
They're going to begin the renovation on a different part of the arena.
But it's even more complicated for the Seattle Partners plan, which they had a longer timeline of 26 months from the beginning of construction to the opening. And they were anticipating starting in November 2018, a full 5 months before the arena would be available if the NCAA tournament remains there. And still, based on that, we're going anticipating opening in January 2021, 3 months more or less after the Oakview plan. So if you push that timeline back starting in March 2019, it's not until, I think, June of 2021 that they would open. So, or May of 2021, I guess.
Okay, what about the deals that each of them have proposed?
All right, so both of them proposed 35-year leases, which is good news in terms of locking.
How did they get to propose the lease?
I mean, the city gets to negotiate with them on the terms. I mean, they don't have to accept that. Okay. It seems likely that the timetable would stay that. The original Hansen Memorandum of Understanding, which no longer is in force now, they don't want to go by anymore now that they're privately financing the arena. That was for 30 years. The Oakview, it's 35 years with the right to extend for 5 consecutive 10-year terms. And AEG's, the Seattle Partners Group, is 35 years with the option to extend for 3 additional terms of 10 years each. So rent and financing is where these really start to diverge in a significant way. The Oakview plan, as we've talked about in the past, fully privately finances the actual construction of the arena. And then they're offering $1 million a year in rent, plus an additional up to one, or I think plus an additional 1 million when arena performance meets defined standards. So basically, if they're making enough off the arena, events at the arena, they will pay the city 2 million a year in rent.
It's like a split point, basically.
Yeah. The Seattle Partners Plan is a game.
Do they own the arena at that point?
I think the city continues to own the arena. They just manage it.
So they're paying them $1 million per year to manage the arena.
Yes.
Basically to be the exclusive partner in the arena for whatever they'd like to do.
Yeah. So the Seattle Partners Group, as we've discussed, asked for $250 million in public financing via municipal bonds. And to pay for that, they propose a $5 million lease to start, which will be adjusted for inflation. And then on top of that, the city also gets the ticket, parking, and B&O taxes, which I think I believe the Oakview Group would have waived, and I think that the Hansen Group similarly would want to waive most of those taxes as part of their agreement. And then on top of that, the city also gets a $5 facility fee per ticket, which is really interesting. So the independent financial analysis of this that was done for Seattle Partners, they're estimating that it will generate $144 million in surplus revenues above and beyond what would be needed to repay the bonds over the life of this this lease. So compare that with, you know, the Oakview Group. At most, the city would be making $70 million in terms of $2 million a year in rent. So it could potentially be more financially lucrative for the city to do this Seattle Partners offer, despite the fact that they're, you know, having to use some of their bonding capacity to finance it up front. But the interesting aspect of this is then the $5 facility fee on top of the existing admissions tax that the city already collects on any ticket you buy in the city of Seattle. And that's going to add a not insignificant amount. I mean, if it's, you know, it's a sweet ticket, $5 is probably not that much. But if it's, you know, the $10 tickets that are the cheapest, that the NBA mandates you have a certain number of $10 tickets, suddenly that's adding a pretty significant percentage. Or, you know, if you're buying relatively cheap tickets to a Seattle Storm game or to a concert that's there, it's a way basically that instead of passing the cost of building the arena on to the city, they're passing it on to the users.
Yes.
Which is better than passing it on to the city, but not as good as not passing it on at all.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something that we face in music a lot. Like, we see facility fees on almost every concert that we book, right? But in sports, I assume that these fees are there. We just don't see them quite as presently, which is also probably the case in music.
They're not as specific as this.
And but this is, we're talking, if you bought a ticket through Ticketmaster or whatever the ticketing service was, you would pay the ticket price plus the facility fee, right? Like a base ticket price, say it's $10, as mandated by the league, plus a facility fee of $5, plus the ticketing fees of $7 or whatever, and then a $10 ticket becomes like $25.
Yes. And the other aspect of this is, I'm not, and I need to look into this a little more, but what does that mean in terms of the tenant, the NBA and NHL tenants? Because, you know, it's not desirable for them to have to pay bill five extra dollars for every ticket they're selling. Yes. That's a significant deterrent for them. It's possible they may exclude the NBA and NHL. The financial analysis that was in here assumed there would be no NBA and NHL ticket fees.
Any conversation with the NBA or NHL about this?
I don't know.
Because again, it's something that in concerts happens every single event, right? So this is something that if it was built into a ticket, you know, the ticket buyer may not see it, right? But it's something that everybody was comfortable with across the board. But if the NBA is demanding, if there's a mandate that you have $10 tickets, it's a different deal. Because yeah. There's no mandate on an Ariana Grande ticket.
And there's no owner to act as kind of the middleman in this point.
Yes.
So whether they've had that discussion with the league is one thing. Whether they've had that discussion with prospective owners is another one altogether.
Yeah.
And it sort of may hint at the idea that, you know, this has been kind of mooted with both of these plans, that maybe they're more designed to be, you know, music venues than a place for NBA and NHL teams, despite being built to those specifications. So,
but also it makes me think about the podcast that Steve Ballmer did with Bill Simmons, and they talked a lot about ticketing and how owners like Steve Ballmer want to have a lot more control over their ticketing and how it's handled.
Right.
And this gives less control to an owner.
Right. Whereas the Soto Arena, you know, the NBA ownership would be the same, more or less, as the owners of the arena led by Chris Hansen and his group. And they would, you know, have common ownership and not have these sort of issues.
Yeah. They'll do whatever the fuck they want. Okay. Anyway.
I mean, they would potentially have it with NHL ownership, which would be different. So,
what about some other aspects of these proposals?
Let's see here. Traffic is another big part of this. And it's interesting. I would say that the Seattle Partners proposal spent a lot more time dealing with traffic effects than the Oakview group did, where they only devoted 15 pages to it.
Well, only 15 pages?
I mean, the Seattle Partners thing was like 40 pages. I had to start skimming by the end. It was a lot. A lot of common ideas here. Both of them want to make use of Westlake Center. Both of them talk about partnering with local bars and restaurants to encourage, you know, give discounts and encourage fans to come early, stay late, so that you kind of manage the traffic from in that way. So some similarities there. Some differences, I guess I would say. Oakview specifically mentions playing a, quote, lead role in dialogue about expanding the monorail platform.
To what? It's a monorail. Do they want to go to two rails?
No, just the platform itself.
Okay.
They mentioned buses to park and rides. Both of them talk about possible shuttles to locations in South Lake Union where people would be able to park now that there's a lot more parking down there, and it will be a little easier to get across 99 once those streets are connected after the tunnel is complete.
Okay. Is there more parking in South Lake Union?
There's parking in South Lake Union.
Okay. Okay.
There is probably more than in the Queen Anne, lower Queen Anne area at this point, I would say.
Okay.
Seattle Partners, I thought, had some interesting thoughts here. So they have offered to commit up to $5 million total among a variety of different transportation projects, up to $1 million to create a mobility hub in connection with the light rail station that will be built on the Seattle Center campus in, I think, 2035 is the estimated opening of that. Well down the road, but at some point.
Fingers crossed.
Up to $1 million to the Seattle Department of Transportation to use active traffic management signals to, like, smart traffic signals, basically, to better deal with traffic on Mercer, I think. Up to $1 million for the Thomas Street Greenway, whatever that is. And then up to $1.5 million for walking and biking networks from South Lake Union, generally speaking, I think. So those are the main things. They also offer to build a bike center. Of course, the difference with the Oakview Group, and one of the differences with the Oakview Group, is they're planning to build a new 850-car parking garage adjacent to the arena. But one of the interesting things that we found out in this proposal that we didn't know previously is that they're saying that's contingent on securing public support funding from public agencies other than the city, which would mean the Port of Seattle, by all accounts, would pay for this parking garage.
And why would they do that?
Because the arena wouldn't be in Soto.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So taxpayers would be paying for this parking garage for the Port of Seattle. So there you go.
I have nothing to say about that. No. This is just the Port of Seattle spending money, giving money to a different proposal to keep the arena out of Soto.
Yep. They are very serious about it.
Oh, man. What if... Okay, here's the worst case scenario for the Port of Seattle. Which... do you have more on these proposals?
I have a couple more notes.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, there's like a few hundred pages each. Now, granted, I didn't do notes on every single one of the letter of recommendation that AEG got from like every single person they've ever worked with in history.
Okay. Do you feel like there's a chance that what we're leading towards is Key Arena being renovated to be used as more or less what it's used as now? A facility for concerts, which probably makes more sense for AEG owning Bumbershoot, but a facility for concerts and maybe some sort of fringier sports.
And also a Soto Arena, or?
And also a Soto Arena for basketball and hockey.
Well, that's where it gets interesting, because the Seattle Partners proposal also includes a non-complete compete clause that would prohibit Seattle from facilitating the construction of an arena between 10,000 and 25,000 seats. So there would not be a Soto Arena under that scenario.
So they could make a 27,000 seat arena, but
yeah, I mean, that's not practical.
Okay,
it's basically saying anything between, yes, like, I guess a soccer civic stadium would be the smallest thing that would be bigger than that.
Man, that's,
and, you know, a like a fancier Seattle University arena, something along those lines.
Still, that would be a dangerous thing for them to sign.
Yes, and again, they don't have to accept everything that's in these proposals. They can negotiate on them. That's a trouble spot. The Oakview proposal does not have anything like that.
Which one is Oakview?
Oakview is Tim Leiwicki.
The AG proposal? No, that's the
Leiwicki. AG is part of Seattle Partners. Oakview, let's talk about concessions. Oakview proposes to run concessions and partner with Delaware and North, which does a variety of stadiums. TD Garden is the only NBA arena it looked like that they have, and retaining all income from that. Seattle Partners mentioned in their... We proposed a flavor of the Northwest concessions, and here's the various restaurants and breweries they mentioned.
I'm excited to hear
with.
This.
Yeah. I don't know if they've actually...
Tacos like, Chuky's better be on
no,
there.
Sadly not.
The Pumpkin's best burger in Seattle has to be.
No, but at least one place you'll like. I don't know how much they've actually negotiated with these places.
They just name some restaurants. Weird. They're like, what restaurants do you like?
Anthony's Restaurants, Cafe Vita, Duke's Chowder House, Fremont Brewing,
which would be good.
Jones Soda, Macrina Bakery, Maud Pizza, which is interesting in as much as Macrina is also owned by the same person as Pagliacci, so to have a competing pizza is a little strange to me.
Is that true?
Yep.
I don't think that's true.
That is
Matt
true.
Galvin owns Macrina?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Purple, the wine bar, the Pike Brewing Company, Red Hook, Theo Chocolates, and Taco Time.
There we go.
That's the one of
Taco Time Northwest.
Yeah.
Hey, that would be great. I mean, that's so much better than this other Delaware North group, right? That's basically garbage arena concessions.
I don't know. I mean, it's possible that they could have local places as well.
Still, like, if you went to an arena, if there's a new arena opening and they didn't involve local restaurants, you would think that it was a terrible arena that was opening.
It would be disappointing.
That's just not what you do anymore. But that's a good selection. I'm sure they went to those businesses and were like, hey, would you like to be involved in this thing that might hypothetically happen in 2021? And they're like, sure.
Yeah. Some of these places might not exist by then.
Of course.
So the Seattle Partners AEG proposal also would take over all Seattle Center sponsorship and then pay the city the amount that they've been making for that the last 3 years. They propose to add outdoor civic amenities to the campus, including facilities such as open-air basketball courts, multi-purpose activity courts, and a new skate park, since the existing skate park would be relocated either way in the renovation. I think that's pretty much it for the Seattle Partners plan. The Oakview plan also mentions that they'll manage all three Seattle Center parking garages. And the other interesting thing is, well, the Seattle Partners proposal had a lot more about transportation. They didn't show anything about the arena itself, which is really weird. Oakview has very detailed floor plans and basically everything about the arena, which, so there, as we've talked about in the past, their plan is to dig down underground, whereas the Seattle Partners / AEG plan would extend the roof out to the south. And so that does create a much wider concourse. Fans would enter in what's now the upper level, instead of going down the steps to the 100 level, basically. But fans would enter there and then take escalators down if they were going to the lower level, to the 100 level, and a much larger concourse there with new clubs.
The various Duchess and Dukes who are walking over from South Lake Union,
yes,
and biking over would take an elevator down.
There we go. So I think those are the main takeaways.
Those are mini takeaways.
Yeah.
Do you have any overall perspective about either of the proposals?
I still think that the idea of bonding this is going to be very difficult for the city council to work through, given that that was a bit of a hang-up with the Soto Arena proposal. No matter how, you know, how much they may espouse the long-term financial benefits and say that there's not any risk, because the Seattle Partners Group would pay any shortfall in the bond interest that needs to be repaid each year. But still, that's a tough sell.
It's something that they've already told somebody no about.
Right.
It would be hard to go back and tell somebody else yes.
Exactly. So I think that Oakview at this point is the pretty heavy favorite of these two. I would go something like 70-30.
And do you have any perspective about these two versus... It's curious, this conversation that you mentioned that Ed Murray and Chris Hansen had, where Ed Murray asks Chris Hansen, are you okay with us exploring key arena possibilities? Like, if he says no at that point, what happens?
Unclear.
First off, oh, yeah, of course not.
First off, the mayor could continue to do it either way. But yes. I don't know.
I mean, Chris Peterson really has no leverage in that situation.
Chris Peterson doesn't involved at all.
He has a lot of leverage.
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, Chris Hansen has no real leverage. It's an interesting nugget, but I'm not sure that it actually means anything.
Yeah. All right. Well, there we go. So that's a little more about arenas that could be opening in 2021.
That's a lot about arenas that could be open in 2021. But do you have any perspective about
how these... I mean, it's too contingent on who knows what the city council is going to do. We didn't predict that they were going to vote against the street vacation this time a year ago. And we also don't know what's going to happen in the mayoral race in November, which will have a significant impact.
I guess we'll discuss that going forward.
We will.
We've talked about arena stuff for far too long at this point.
All right, quickly.
We've only mentioned Pearl Jam once.
Quickly on the basketball stuff. One more note. Husky men's hoops, according to John Rothstein, tweeted today that the Huskies are in the mix, quote unquote, for UConn transfer Vance Jackson, who is visiting Rutgers this weekend and then also will apparently take a visit to Baylor in addition to UW. He is a 6'8" three-point specialist from LA with 3 years of eligibility and is a freshman, averaged 26.1 minutes per game as they were hit by injuries and made 53-pointers at a 39.6% clip.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah, so he'd be a nice player for the Huskies to have. Yeah. Would not be eligible for next season.
Been in the mix for a lot of players. They haven't gotten his transfers.
That is true. It's hard to see why you would choose UW over Baylor at this point. But, you know, maybe he wants to get back on the West Coast since he's from LA. I think it's time. We've gone a long time. It's time for your favorite segment of the week.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
I'm going to say it. This season for the Mariners has been so far, I know that they won last night, but this season for the Mariners has been so far a fire festival level disaster.
Wow.
And Jerry DePoto is Ja Rule.
Oh, no.
Holla, holla. If you like hitters who hit under 200, dollars, Felix is going to be getting paid forever. Bala, bala. At least Mitch Haniger is coming back at some point. This season has been murder.
That was amazing.
That's all I have. That's the only hot take that I have.
So we talked last week about that devastating loss for the Mariners at Detroit 19-9 in which Felix and Mitch Haniger were injured. They followed that up by winning 3 in a row. And then lost 3 in a row before snapping that streak, as you mentioned, with their come-from-behind 8-7 win on Wednesday night.
It was a nice win, but man, I mean, another game that Iwakuma pitched very badly, who doesn't really look like a professional pitcher at this point.
Not even like an independent league ball?
I think he could be getting paid to baseball somewhere, but doesn't look like an MLB-level starter. And it's going to be hard for him to get back to that point. The other thing is that with the previous game with James Paxton starting, if they lose a game that James Paxton starts...
Which they've lost 3 of them.
It puts a lot of pressure on those other games.
That's true. That is true.
Gene Segura's back and hitting well. Nelson Cruz is hitting well. Basically, all the people that have been good hitters long-term are playing pretty well, right?
Yep.
But nobody else is.
Oh, okay.
And the pitching has been very bad.
What about Taylor Motter? Is he still playing well? Is he still the best player in the Mariners?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But I'm going to say probably.
Yeah, I'm going to go for it.
Look, I can only pay so much attention here. I've been reading these proposals. They're like 400 pages.
You didn't read any of them. What are you talking about? All right. Should we wrap up with the Sounders?
Yeah.
In another game in which you did not pay attention to. The Sounders, a thrilling, come-from-behind, 3-3 draw.
It's kind of been the way the season has been for the Sounders.
Has very much been the way the season has been. But a wild game where it seemed like the Sounders kind of, you know, I was just following this game on Twitter because I was at the Seattle Storm scrimmage on Saturday night. They seemed to generally be controlling the run of play, but New England kept scoring against the run of play and built up a 3-0 lead. And then I think that's where I left and was driving home at that point. Didn't think to put it on the radio. And then I get home and look on Twitter, and lo and behold, the Sounders have drawn the game 3-3 with three goals after.
Sounders won 3-3.
I think the 82nd minute, they scored the first of those three goals. So a pretty incredible comeback at that point.
A brilliant comeback.
Yeah.
And then
a feel-good draw.
Ozzie Alonso finishing it off, finishing off the draw in stoppage time.
With a header. You don't think of Ozzie Alonso scoring a lot of headers. You don't think of Ozzie Alonso scoring that much.
I don't think you can... It's tough to look at this match and feel positive about it.
I mean, I will say that if you look at the expected goals, they were identical, I think, in terms of shot-based expected goals on 538, but the Sounders had a huge edge in terms of the non-shot expected goals. So they kind of dominated possession and, you know, were able to play in their attacking third much more.
How do their expected goals look through the season? Are they still, have they still been unlucky?
Oh yeah, they're still number one in the league in terms of expected
number
goal differential.
Number one in the league?
Yeah.
So we should expect some regression here.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I mean, 538 Soccer Power Index still has the Sounders tied with this week's opponent, who happens to be the team they played in last year's MLS Cup, Toronto FC.
Hello.
They'll host this Saturday. Has those two teams with the top two ratings, identical
hated
ratings,
rivals
atop the Soccer Power Index.
So tell us about Toronto. How's their season gone?
So they have actually been lucky in terms of expected goals. So they're off to a much better start. They're tied for second in the East with 16 points.
They weren't lucky in terms of expected goals in that match.
They were not. That is fair. The Sounders currently tied for sixth in the West on 10 points. They've got major stars. Josie Altidore with 5 goals so far this season and a pair of assists. Sebastian Giovinco, Italian star.
Cheers, Dan.
Always. 3 goals and assists. And then Michael Bradley, the other USMNT stalwart on this team, hasn't had a big statistical impact with 1 assist, but still a star player.
So what should we expect from the Sounders in this match?
I mean, you know, as much as you expect any, I think it'll be very different from last year's MLS Cup, where clearly they played in a show and were very defensive and just tried to get through that game with a draw and get to penalty kicks.
So we should expect a heroic performance from Stefan Fry?
I mean, hopefully. Uh-huh. We should always expect a heroic performance from Stefan Fry. But also, the weather probably will not be like 12 degrees in this game.
You never know.
I haven't checked the forecast for Saturday specifically, but given that it was 73 here today, I don't think it'll be as cold as it was in that one.
But being played in Seattle, you would expect that the Sounders, given their point differential, have a better than 50% chance to pick up 3 points in this match.
Well, 538 says about exactly 50%. So
okay, to win.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As I discussed last week, their odds are always between 50 to 55%
for the home team. I mean, it would be a huge match, right?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, they need points at this point.
They do need points, and it's a rematch of the MLS Cup.
For sure. I'm sure they will be very motivated to win, as if they aren't normally.
Any other thoughts on the Sounders?
I think that pretty much covers it.
I'm going to try to pay attention to this game, so I have any...
It was interesting, by the way. We talked about that back line that had been so successful for them. It had two clean sheets where they had started Tony Alfaro at center back, and then Jordy Delem at right back, the two untested rookies. That group started again last week and gave up 3 goals. So it turns out that they maybe were not the greatest defensive combination in MLS history. It might have just been a small sample size, and they might have regressed to the mean.
Hey, that last match is small sample size.
That's also true. But
pretty much everything is small sample size
in soccer.
Everything is small sample size. Everything will regress to the mean. What are we even doing?
Especially 3-point shooting. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.